course, he comes out of this Greek area, which would, of course, mean the current royal family. Prince Charles and William and what have you. I think Harry won't be, because it looks like he was the result of Princess Diana's affair with somebody else, because he looks very much like him. But this really is so significant, because it again, although we're looking at crypto news now, how many people out there have literally been the result of this group marrying into these so-called aristocratic families of lineages that go back thousands of years, that it's all been disguised, and we don't know that these are actually part of this group as well, only their actions give it away.
Well, excuse me, we talk a little bit here, you go on in 24 to say Joseph Stalin is also of this group. Now, his name actually means, translates in Georgian as son of a Jew.
Yeah, it's like Jewish in, you know, American, they might find America and things like that. It was, the other interesting point with Stalin, this is the name, that is the name. There's a lot of discussion as to whether he was actually Jewish or not. What is clear is that he was married to three wives in his lifetime. They were all Jewish, that is not disputed. And during his premiership, he passed a death sentence on anybody being found guilty of anti-Semitism. So whether he is or he isn't, he's certainly favouring that group. But then other people say at the time of his demise, when it appears quite clear that he was poisoned, he decided to turn against that group because he was worried that they were becoming too powerful and they were going to then try and overthrow him, which incidentally it seems that they did. And so it's one of these grey areas. It's another one like the Hitler thing. Was he a Rothschild? Was he working for this group? Wasn't he? You know, we need to have more access to more archives to really tidy this one up, as opposed to what is out there.
Yeah. Well, now we get into one of my least favorite humans ever, J. Edgar. J. Edgar Hoover did more to destroy individual liberty in America than I can say than just about any individual in American history, and. He was a closet homosexual, a cross-dresser, a transvestite. He was responsible for ordering murder and mayhem. And what are his connections to this criminal gang?
Well, interestingly with Hoover, of course, he was what started off as the Bureau of Investigation and became the FBI. He would be their director for 37 years, from 35 to 72. And I think you've discussed the FBI on his show a few times, and really they're just a real, very shady agency that really seems to be carrying out the edicts of this group rather than anything else. I mean, they'll have you know in Hollywood that they're all out there hunting serial killers and protecting the public, but really they seem to be protecting this group. And of course he was the head of that, and as you said about him being a homosexual, it's what has come out is that he was photographed with engaged in various homosexual acts with the associate director Clyde Tolson, who was his lifelong companion and inherited his entire estate when he died. So it's, from that information, it's clear that they were an item, as it were. And these photos were obtained by the ADL. Through the mafia by Jewish Meyer Lansky, which was used to blackmail Hoover and basically get them to do their bidding. The other interesting thing about Meyer Lansky, now I'm not sure, don't quite remember her first name, but if people, listeners want to go into Google, type in Lansky and type in ADL, you'll find, I believe it's a niece or a great niece or something like that. It's a pretty direct relation who actually works for the ADL. And so she's directly related to this possibly biggest mafia kingpin of the lot, and she's now working for the ADL. So you just type in Lansky, type in ADL, and a woman's name will come up, and you will see that is actually her.
Well,
and that's she's working for them today.
There are no surprises. This is a direct line to the present. There's no doubt about it. We get in here to 22 again. Maurice Samuel worked as a secretary to Shem Weissman, the leader of the World Zionist Movement. What does this say? It says on January 17th, the issue of the Jewish Courier stated what now?
Well, what he stated is, he says that Jews may adopt the customs and language of the countries where they live, but they will never become part of the native population. And this would explain how in all these different countries, whether in Australia, Canada, America, just to name but three, you've always got JDL, ADL, World Jewish Congress, etc., etc. And it's always, you never get this for Irish people, or for Portuguese, or for English, you know, it's always Jewish. And he's merely pointing out there what we can see in practice today, that this group promote the diversity of everybody else, but adopt in their own country of Israel policies where you have to be Jewish to enter the country otherwise, you know, to gain citizenship, etc., etc., have to be born of a Jewish mother. And at the same time, all through their media throughout the world, they can't promote diversity enough, while at the same time trying to ensure that they stay with their own people.
Well, we get into actually discussing now the first attempts of stealing the region of Palestine, and of course Rothschild was behind that with his Balfour signings through the British government. But of course there was a large amount of money being made available for this venture, and there still is today. We know that many of the public buildings were paid for by Rothschild. We know that families, Jewish people who want to move from America or Britain into Israel, get a stipend. They get free money to live for a period of time, money to set up their home. So my point being is that the monies are still flowing for this criminal hole-in-the-wall country to go over there and murder, rape, pillage, and plunder a people of the Middle East. But what we talk here again here in 1925, I'm skipping a little bit here, but the Jewish Encyclopedia states the existence of Ashkenazi Jews who represent approximately 90% of world Jewry, which is the starting admission that the so-called enemy of the Jews, Esau, also known as Edom in the Genesis, now actually represent the Jewish race. And it's interesting that they usurped the previous controllers of Judaism, which were, of course, the arm of the Spanish Judaism, which was the Sephardic. Now, they were the holders and keepers of Judaism, and they adhered to a mixture of Torah and Talmud. But this new group kind of put the Torah aside and began living almost exclusively from Talmudic and Zoharist and Sanhedrin work. In other words, they switched their ideology in a major way. You want to talk a little bit about this happening, them coming to the pinnacle of control?
Yeah, well, capitalistic as well, Darrell, their practices. I mean, what they're essentially, the reason I put this in, and is that it's one of the few, we have a lot of missions from Jewish sources about, you know, banking, etc. It can be almost quite cocky the way that they write about things, sort of putting it, you know, one article out there in your face about stuff is almost what you're going to do about it. But here we've actually got the admission that they're saying that they're essentially God's chosen people out of the Bible, etc., etc. And now they're saying that Edom is in modern Jewry in the actual Jewish encyclopedia of that year. And so Esau Edom was actually supposed to be the non-Jews, and this is where I kind of tied the two together and thought, hey, this is one of the few admissions that I've seen for Ashkenazi Jews. Of course, we'd have to wait till many years later for the for Arthur Kessler's 13th Tribe book, which I know you've got up on your site, but that which goes into greater detail about this Ashkenazi group. But it was interesting here because it seemed to be one of the first admissions I've seen about this group.
Well, what we're going to do right now is take a break. The reason is I have to take a break. And what we're going to do, Andrew, is return in about 3 or 4 minutes. For the listener, it will be just a snap on the a little blip, and we'll go to the next file. When we do, we're going to move on to the year 1925-26, and going all the way up to where we ended off last time in the 30s. But we'll do that in just a moment. Is that okay with you, Andrew?
That's absolutely fine, Dale.
All right. Just a moment, ladies and gentlemen. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, after our little break here. And I want to get right back into our discussion with Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. 1926, ladies and gentlemen, N.M. Rothschild refinances the Underground Electric Railway Company of London. What this points to, and I'm going to ask Andrew to talk a little bit about the tentacles of the financial empire. Everyone seems to talk about the bankers, okay? The banker, yes, they did start out as bankers. Yes, they did make their initial fortunes and prove them their power base in finance. But what they have done in the last century is move themselves into almost every other facet of life as well. And you can see it here in Europe, ownership of electric companies and water systems and water companies. So banking is only where they started. And this is a little bit of evidence that all the way back in 1926, they were already well advanced into taking over other parts of the economy. You want to speak to some of that, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, in 1926, what we've got is quite interesting, because we have David Sarnoff launching the first radio chain in America, which was the service of RCA. And he then goes on to be heavily involved in the development of colour television and build NBC into one of the big three TV networks. And later on we can, we sort of, just to stay on the same subject, jump forward to 1928, William S. Paley, another Jew, found CBS Radio and goes on to build that into a multi-billion-dollar TV empire. So we can see the similarity there of what they're trying to do.
Well, and you talk here about Maurice de Rothschild, his son Edmund, in 1927. The Jewish Tribune says here in an article, Masonry is based on Judaism, and it eliminates the teachings of Judaism from the Messianic ritual and what's left. Basically nothing. So we want to speak to the connection between Freemasonry, especially the Orient tradition, which is the Parisian Lodge. Am I correct?
It is, yes. I think that the interesting thing that the what we have here, I mean, Isaac Wise, a rabbi, in the same year says Freemasonry is a Jewish establishment whose history, grades, official appointments, passwords and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end. And what we'll find in, I think, will be our last show on the book, is in 1776. This is when we've got Adam Weishaupt, under the instruction of Rothschild, infiltrating the Masonic lodges. So there are going to be people out there that say, hey, these Masonic lodges have been around for centuries before this. Whether they were or they weren't back then under this control, they certainly are now, and we can point to the infiltration 150 years prior to what we're talking about in the 1927, the year we're discussing now.
That's right. And of course, what we do know is that the York Rite has had a separation from them in some ways. One of the British Freemasonry rites will not recognize the Orient Rite because of its it's moving away from God. But I don't know if any of it's any good. It all sounds fishy to me. I don't.
Yeah,
know
I agree. I think all of them are based on the idea behind it, whether you've got the York Rite or whatever. It seems to be a group of people getting together and awarding each other contracts, and you have some person who's a doctor, someone's an estate agent, somebody works for a local council, and they'll band together. So if somebody's got a property they want to extend it, they'll go to the person the local council, so they'll pass the planning permission, etc., etc. So it's all about helping each other out and not going through proper means. So if for example, you live next door to somebody who wants to build an extension on their property that's going to overlook your property and lower the cost of yours or make your life less pleasant because you're not so secluded, if that person is in the Masons and they can just speak to someone in the Masons who's in the local council, and of course there's lots of them because they love all these getting jobs like that to get, and they love any sort of influence that they can get, and they will get an unfair advantage over you, so you won't get treated fairly.
Well, yeah, it, you know, see, the Freemasonry, and that's another place where these so-called truth seekers stop. They stop at the door of Freemasonry, and they don't go behind it and discuss in any significant sense the connections it has to Judaism and the Ashkenazi community. And this is why I have been so aggressive at attacking people like Alex Jones and his supporters for being semi-truth tellers. And I think what ends up happening when you tell half the story is you are moving people away from the real culprits, and that may in fact be the goal.
Well, I agree, and I'd like to reinforce that anybody who doesn't go to the next level and stops at Freemasonry, stops at the CFR, etc., they are bad and they are not to be trusted. And as you're aware, I've even it's long concerned me about Alex Jones's relationship to Tex Miles, who of course published my book, because I believe the work that I've seen that Tex has done, I've read every one of his books, I've listened to him, I've spoken to him myself, and his actual work, his newsletters, always come across as exactly what I'm looking at. They come across as truth, and it's a great shame that he endorses Alex Jones, and I have addressed this issue with him. I'm waiting for a response, but it puts me in a difficult situation because, of course, people say, well, hey, this guy's publishing your book and he endorses Alex Jones. How do you explain that? Well, the answer is I can't. The material he's put out, whenever I've heard him, the books I've read, seems to be right on the money, and it's just a great shame that he has chosen to do that, and I hope that, we can show Alex Jones to be who he is, and Tex will realize that this guy's not to be trusted either.
Well, I mean, I was invited on recently to do a Tex Mars show, and of course, because I have the same sense that you do that he does talk about these issues, I decided it would be an outlet for some of my research to get to the listeners and adherence to Tex's work. And I have the same misgivings about his relationship to Alex Jones, and I've brought it up with him before, and he seems to think that the fact that that Alex Jones is a slow learner is a good enough explanation. I certainly don't buy that. However, let's move on here and talk a little bit about Rothschild's first major publication back in 1928 called La Revue de Paris, which is he is a wholly owned Rothschild publication. And what did they say in that? It was a Karl Marx from Bernard Baruch, reprinted as an extract from the following, reads as follows. Tell the people what this says.
What this is we've got, they published a letter from a guy called Baruch Levy, a name that I've, it's one of the only times I've stumbled upon this, but it's to Karl Marx. And they published this long letter in there, and there's an extract, which I quote in the book, and the extract reads as follows: the Jewish people as a whole will be its own messiah. It will attain world dominion by the dissolution of other races, by the abolition of frontiers, the annihilation of monarchy. And if we stop here, attain world dominion by the dissolution of other races, well, they're behind trying to get this world governed by dragging races into different countries and turning all countries into a kind of multicultural country. So that's dissolution of races there.
Yep.
The abolition of frontiers, well, what we've got, European Union, North American Union, they're getting rid of all the frontiers there, so we've got that bit. The annihilation of monarchy, how many monarchies have they dispelled? Look at Russia.
Yep.
Look at these countries like that. So we've got that. And by this, then we'll go back to the quote. By the establishment of a world republic in which the Jews will everywhere exercise the privilege of citizenship, in this new world order, one of the earliest uses of this term, the children of Israel will furnish all the leaders without encountering opposition. Again, something again we see today, where you've got your neocons in George Bush's cabinet. He then goes on to say, the governments of the different peoples forming the world republic will fall without difficulty into the hands of the Jews. It will then be possible for the Jewish rulers to abolish private property and everywhere to make use of the resources of the state. Thus will the promise of the Talmud be fulfilled, in which it is said that when the messianic time is come, the Jews will have all the property of the whole world in their hands. And of course, that is, again, the Talmudic belief that the Jews... any non-Jew is no more than cattle, and they're there for the Jews to exploit. And the interesting thing that I think we've covered before, or you've covered with other guests, is this premise that when people talk about the Jews waiting for their Messiah, what's actually come out is the Jewish people are their own Messiah. And so their idea of the Messiah is them having control of the world. That is the Messiah for them.
Well, we go on to 29 in the crash, and of course Rothschild and Warburg send out warnings to all their friends of the imminent collapse. Now, by their friends, we mean the crypto-Jews in government already in place in 1929, as well as the people significant in their organization in the North America and the world, in Europe as well. And what they do basically is get these people to position themselves outside the collapse so that after the event they can profit from it. Now, this is exactly what we're seeing today again, a repeat of history, where Goldman Sachs, in advance of the housing debacle back in June, 2 months prior to everything going bad, started setting up short positions on all of these housing stocks and all of these housing positions and bonds and whatnot, profiting from the demise of the housing market in America well in advance of it. So what we've got is a repeat of history, sadly. But the fact is we've got evidence that they were well aware that 1929 was going to take place. Am I correct in saying that?
Oh, yes, it was all orchestrated and planned. I mean, even today, I mean, we've got a situation where Halifax Bank of Scotland has just announced that they're doing a £4 billion share issue. And so it's all about getting the money coming in to cover what the losses that they've made and try and make it an attractive option. Here, what we've got is the biographies is quite amusing. Of the so-called giants of that era, which was Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan Jr., Joe Kennedy, Bernard Baruch, they all marvel at the fact that these people got out of the stock market completely just before the crash and put their assets into cash or gold, because they were so clever, you see, they saw it coming. Well, they did see it coming because they orchestrated it. And so the idea was it's like anything, back then there were, there's a story that, Joe Kennedy said, which is a complete load of nonsense, but he said he decided to get out of the stock market when he was walking down a road one day and someone came up to him who was just a blue-collar worker and asked if he should get into these shares or these shares, because he already had these certain shares, and he thought, if someone at that level can be having shares, it's not a good market to be in. But you see, what he's actually really saying there is job done. We've got as much as the population as we're going to get their money in these shares, so now's the time to pull the plug, and then we can buy them all back for pennies on the dollar. And so we've essentially just taken all this money from these people, and we've got control of all these industries.
Well, that's exactly what's happening in America today with real estate. They already own the businesses, so now what's going to happen is when people lose their homes, not only will they own the companies that sell them goods and services, but they'll also own the buildings that these people reside in. And the fact of the matter is, that is entire and complete servitude, and it's all held by the same group, and they're buying this now at pennies on the dollar. We are in for a terrible ride here, ladies and gentlemen. Keep your hat on. Lewis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, actually came out in a statement in front of Congress and said it's not accidental. It was carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might emerge as rulers of us all. And in fact, he said it like it was. I think someone actually tried to take him out. If I recall when one of my readings, you may be able to shed light on that. But here it goes on to talk about the Federal Reserve in the 29 to 33 period. You want to add some value to that, please?
Yeah, I think that we mentioned him in the last fall, Darrell. He certainly had a number of assassination attempts on him, and he's one of the, along with Andrew Jackson, one of the real heroes of this book, of this history, the people that really stood out to me, who really took these people on, despite repeated assassination attempts. Unfortunately, unlike Andrew Jackson, he would die as a result of a poisoning in the late 30s, I believe. But what he says here, I mean, he's actually, the Federal Reserve, when they were formed, they actually claimed that the Federal Reserve would protect the country against depressions and inflation. However, what they did instead was between 1929 and 33, they contracted the money supply by 33%. Milton Friedman, the Peace Prize winning economist, said in 1996, the Federal Reserve, and this was a radio interview in January 96, the Federal Reserve definitely caused the Great Depression by contracting the amount of currency in circulation by one third from 1929 to 1933. And there you have it, somebody omitting from this banking community some 65 years later. What we all know actually happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, and of course you bring up the Kennedy family, and you know, goodness knows who what their connections are to these people, but Lewis McFadden, of course, lost his life as you mentioned in the late 30s. This was at a time when the real theft of the rest of the world, the real redrawing of the lines of barriers, I mean, of countries and societies through war, after they had imploded everything and took all the assets, then they decided to redraw the maps of the world, and of course that required them to sacrifice 58 million human beings in a world war. So let's start getting into that now. It says it talks a little bit here about the bankers getting involved in financing and subsidizing the German government so that Adolf Hitler could actually build a war machine in preparation for this redrawing of the world's maps. Is this not the case?
Well, it's interesting, Darrell, because you've had Eustace Mullins on your show a number of occasions.
Yep.
And he, as you'll remember, said that World War II was always going to happen as a result of World War I, and it was designed to happen. World War I was one step in the direction they wanted to go in, and World War II was the next. And if we take that statement that Eustace made and we look at what Louis T. McFadden, again, and this is the chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee from 1920 to 1931, what he stated in relation to this is a bit of a long quote, but it's worth going through. He said, after World War I, Germany fell into the hands of German international bankers. These bankers bought her, and now they own her lock, stock, and barrel. They have purchased her industries, they have mortgages on her soil, they control her production, they control all her public utilities. The international German bankers have subsidized the present government of Germany, and they have also supplied every dollar of the money Adolf Hitler has used in his lavish campaign to build up a threat to the government of Berlin. When Berlin fails to obey the orders of the German international bankers, Hitler is brought forth to scare the Germans into submission. Through the Federal Reserve Board, over $30 billion of American money has been pumped into Germany. You have all heard of the spending that has taken place in Germany, modernistic dwellings, her great planetariums, her gymnasiums, her swimming pools, her fine public highways, her perfect factories. All this was done with our money. All this was given to Germany through the Federal Reserve Board. The Federal Reserve Board has pumped so many billions of dollars into Germany that they dare not name the total. And the money that was pumped in really in preparation for World War II, and it was going into the German Seifenbanks. This is where Louis McFadden did
did, but I mean, we had Paul Warburg.
We had Paul Warburg in America, financing the American effort, and Max Warburg in Germany. And so when he talks about the German International Bank, because he's talking about this Zionist group, and of course the Feinstein banks, which were affiliated with Rothschild Harriman interests in New York.
Well, we've also seen a similar event happening in the 1980s, late 80s and through the 90s, with massive amounts of money coming out of companies like General Electric and Ford and Renault. All of these companies are Jewish-owned and operated, into China. So what we've seen is huge amounts of capital coming out of all types of Jewish organizations and being invested into Chinese factories. And what we're seeing now is the destruction of countries that provided that capital, including the American public who financed these businesses like General Electric and Ford and so forth, and the demise of the country that did the supporting. So it looks like they're jumping from one parasitic host to another.
Oh, they do. I mean, this is the whole nature of it, and it's interesting to see. I mean, for example, the deindustrialization of America now, that it's the same in the UK. We don't have any industrial base. We have ridiculous laws of, farmers being paid not to grow certain things, even though they've got the land, etc., to do so, because it's about control. It's not about economics or anything like that, only in their favor. If people have got the ability to do things, they should be able to do them, but they want to give us certain food that's mass-produced, and they want to force the farmers to use their own the horrible pesticides that they prepare, full of chemicals, as opposed to growing things naturally. They want to promote GM. All these different things. It's all about control, and then they have the audacity to pay people not to grow things on their land. And now what are we looking at? A food shortage. And would this really be happening if the countries were as they were, say 50, maybe 80, 100 years ago, where they essentially were self-sufficient? But what they've done is, because they want to make this world order, as it were, they want to decide who grows what where, and so you have to go to this country for this country for that, in order to push their idea of globalization, whereas, apart from things such as toffee, pretty much every country can sustain itself and feed its own population out of food grown in their own countries.
Well, and that allows them to weaponize food, which is exactly what's happening today. Here's the big stranglehold organization that has grown up in the last 75 years as being the most powerful bank in the world, a Rothschild invention called the BIS, or the Bank of International Settlement, and basically what it's centered in Switzerland. What it does is it is the bank of the bankers, and ratifies and codifies the rules between different banks in the organizations that they control to start with. One of the things that was given to them over nobody resisted it, but they were given diplomatic immunity, this bank. Now, they're given the same status as a country. They have diplomatic immunity when they carry documents. They're not taxed. They have an embassy-style immunity. No oversight of knowledge of operations, freedom of immigration restrictions, freedom to encrypt, freedom from legal jurisdiction. In other words, they are basically above the law.
Well, absolutely, and it's very interesting when you see, you hear about different things getting into countries. We hear about secrets getting out of the US to Israel. If you talk about a lot of these, people that we've got have been on trial in the United States for passing military secrets to Israel, etc. And these are the sort of ways they're going to get them out of the country and over to them. And how you can have a private corporation being able to go border to border, completely unchecked, complete diplomatic immunity for anything they do, they have their own police force. And the interesting thing about Bank of International Settlements, or the BIS, is a lot of people, you hear about the IMF riots or the World Bank riots, but you very rarely hear about the Bank of International Settlements, and they are the top one. They are what's referred to as the central banks for the central banks. So essentially what they will do is the World Bank will deal with governments, as will the IMF. They'll loan money to governments, but the BIS will only deal with other central banks, so they will only loan their money of their central bank to other central banks. So they're kind of the nucleus, if you like, and the central banks go off that, and then the central banks go to the government from that. So they're the core, central banks and then governments afterwards.
Well, we start reading a little bit about some vilified politicians in America. One of them that I learned about in my history books, and they didn't tell me this, Henry Cabot Lodge, saying that we should not get involved with this Bank of International Settlement, that it was a sovereignty issue, and that there were serious flaws in the whole design of the system. And of course, they vilified him. What other situations can you bring to light with this group?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing with this Bank of International Settlements is the U.S. actually held off officially for many years, and Greenspan was attending the meetings, which he shouldn't have been doing, and it should have been disclosed as part of the record. It never was, but it was proved that he'd attended many of the meetings over many years, and it was only official that the United States were part of Bank of International Settlements in 94. Carol Quigley, in his book Tragedy and Hope, he had a few things to say about the Bank of International Settlements. He talked about the financial system of each country, the economy as a whole. The system was going to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreement derived at infrequent meetings and conferences. And he says himself, the apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements. He calls the Bank for International Settlements a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. So this is, you know, Carol Quigley here, who, incidentally, Bill Clinton, as I recall, referred to as his mentor.
There you go. And then he was a bad guy. He was up to his eyeballs in the elites, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, it's so much in your face. Bill Clinton saying this guy's his mentor. Bill Clinton will do everything to protect the Fed, and this guy's his mentor, saying in his book, Jordan saying that, confirming the BIS is a private bank, and then following that with the line, oh, controlled by the world's central banks, which are all private corporations. And so there is no Fed, there is no Bank of England, they're all private corporations, and there it's admitted there, the president at the time saying that this guy's his mentor. Well, why has nothing done about it then?